Hello, and welcome back to Codex Radio. As always, I'm your host, Endless Odyssey. Well, another Wednesday, another podcast, my dudes, and today we have episode 8, which is part 4 of season 2, wherein we are reading You Died, a Dark Souls companion. Before we get into today's reading, I just wanted to mention, some of you might have noticed last week's episode appearing in your feeds a few days early. This was not intentional, I just goofed, so... I think it was up for about 2 days over the weekend before I noticed that I had made an error, so if you were able to listen to it early, then, well, good for you, I suppose. If you somehow ended up without an episode 7 at all come Valentine's Day, then my apologies, but just check the feed, it should be in there now. That's it for updates this week, folks. I now give you part 4 of You Died, A Dark Souls Companion by Keeza McDonald and Jason Killingsworth. Soulmates, Finding Romance in Blighttown, by Keeza McDonald. If you were to think of good games to play with a new romantic partner, an adventure game perhaps, or a co-op shooter to get the blood pumping, perhaps a pass-the-pad platformer, Dark Souls probably wouldn't rank high on the list. Playing something as frustrating, demanding, and, let's be honest, bleak as a Souls game together wouldn't strike many people as an aphrodisiac, or a catalyst for cheery romantic well-being. It's got to be one of the least romantic games ever made. For one couple I met, though, Dark Souls was one of the things that drew them together in the early stage of their relationship, and Dark Souls kept them together, over distance and time, as their connection deepened. Alex and Leanne first met back in 2007. At the time, she was working in video game retail, and he was a game designer. They're both game designers now. They didn't start dating, however, until the beginning of 2012, at which point they were living at different ends of England. Their primary method of communication for the next several months wasn't drawn-out phone conversations or even Skype, but Dark Souls via the magic of Xbox Live Party Chat. Instead of long phone calls, they had long nights in Blighttown. What could be more romantic than scything away at leeches together in a poisonous swamp? Leanne had tried Dark Souls the previous year, but didn't get as far as the Undeadburg before her housemate traded the game in for Skyrim. I got further than my housemate did at that point, but in the wrong direction. I only got as far as the New Londo ruins and ended up stuck there for hours, she laughs. But when me and Alex started dating, we were at a conference together and he was having a power rant about Dark Souls. As we were walking toward the station to go our separate ways, he was like, "Right, there must be a game shop around here." And so he dragged me to a game station and bought me another copy. I was kind of sold because he preaches an awful lot about Dark Souls. He evangelizes quite heavily about it. As soon as I realized the first time I played it I hadn't gone the right way, I was like, oh, I have to go up the hill. I mean, from Firelink Shrine, you've got 4 options of where to go, and 3 of them are very wrong. Alex, meanwhile, had already finished Dark Souls, having heard about it from his boss, who was a big Demon Souls fan. But rather misguidedly, he'd played it solo, without actually connecting to the internet and taking part in the community of fellow players, invaders, and message leavers. The first time I played it through, I did it offline. I didn't want to get invaded. It was the fear of the unknown, but it's not the real experience, he says. I'm glad I did it because it was an achievement, but also because I got to play the game twice, and it was a completely different game the second time around, with cooperation and invasions. And messages, all those bastards telling you to jump off a ledge. Half the community wants to fuck you up, but the other half of the community, the only reason they're there is either because they haven't played it before, or because they have played it before, and all they want to do is help you find all the things. In that respect, the community is self-policing. It's there to help the newer members get through and experience the thing as it should be experienced. Playing Dark Souls together, then, was a new experience for the both of them. For Leanne, because the whole game was new to her, and for Alex, because playing Dark Souls with other people is such a vastly different experience to disconnecting and trying to solo through. Night after night, they'd sit at opposite ends of the country and work their way through the Undeadburg, On Orlando, Lost Izalith. As anyone who's ever tried to arrange a co-op game on the console version of Dark Souls knows, it's not exactly an easy process. primarily because From Software intentionally made it difficult, preferring people to engage in serendipitous multiplayer encounters rather than coordinating with their friends. The whole convoluted process of trying to get a co-op game going in Dark Souls became a metagame in itself for Alex and Leanne. They'd hide their summoning signs in special pre-agreed places. "We've got this big library of usual spots where we put them. The best ones are in urns," says Alex, and logs in and out until they find themselves on the right servers. Alex had to really watch his own reactions. He didn't want to spoil anything for Leanne as they went. When you're playing co-op games, and there's a discrepancy in experience, i.e. one person has played it before, that can really ruin it, he told me. So I made a point of hanging back, saying, "You're going through this, and I'm your wingman." I would warn her now and then, or point out if we accidentally gone past somewhere important, like kicking down the ladder in the Undeadburg, but only in dire circumstances. "He did a very good job of not spoiling things," says Leanne. "Except when we'd just come back from Mon Orlando and he said, 'We're going back to Firelink now, and there's going to be something there that you may think you have to kill, but you don't.' Meaning Frampt, of course. There were some bits that Alex was very excited about, but he couldn't tell me anything about them. Like the first time the gaping dragon appeared. He built that up quite a bit before it happened, but I had no idea what to expect. It was always especially fun when I pointed out something he didn't know, like that wheel at the back of Blighttown Swamp. It's powered by those fire-breathing dogs running around and turning the lift. He'd never noticed that detail before." As the months passed, Dark Souls started to affect the language of their relationship. They would visit each other's towns twice a month and started to referring to the purchase of train tickets as placing a summon sign. They affectionately referred to a town near their current home as On Orlando because of its beautiful old church and castle. Normally, they tell me, playing games is kind of a busman's holiday for the both of them because they're game developers, but being game developers also gave them a special appreciation of Dark Souls' exquisite design, the way it both embraces and subverts all the worn conventions of video games. The two hollow walls that lead down to the Ash Lake are a favorite Dark Souls trick of theirs, the double-double bluff, a joke that only works because Dark Souls is always rewriting what you should expect. I wondered, though, as a person who has played many, many games with romantic partners, and not always harmoniously, whether Dark Souls caused arguments for them. What if Alex missed tagging Smo with a soul arrow right before he brought his hammer down on Leanne? What if Leanne ran heedlessly across a walkway in Sen's fortress and fell to her death, meaning they'd have to start the whole Sen's run again? The Four Kings are enough to make you hate yourself, let alone whomever you happen to have the misfortune of sitting nearby. "We're absolutely fine with Dark Souls," says Alex, surprisingly. "Well, there is just one bone of contention, and that is, we were going through Sen's Fortress in her game, and we turned the corner and walked down the stairs to Onionbro, Sigmire of Katarina, and I ended up taking on some serpent soldiers on the way, and through some strange series of events, because I was fighting the serpents on the staircase, one of them accidentally fell down and hit Onionbro, and he got knocked off the cliff." "And that was the end of that storyline," says Leanne. "I'm still one achievement short." Eventually, Leanne and Alex moved in together, by which point they were on New Game Plus and trawling for achievements. They once spent a whole evening in Lost Izalith with some friends, all trying to get into the same game and exchange upgraded weapons. They'd since helped numerous other friends on their journey through the game too, passing on the favor that Alex paid Leanne. "We've basically set ourselves up as a Dark Souls taxi service," laughs Leanne. "Oh, you've never played it? You must. In fact, here are our details. Give us a call when you get in, and we'll help you through the hardest bits." Leanne's favorite moment of the whole experience is one she presumably shares with plenty of Dark Souls fans, the gargoyle flight to On Orlando. "It's because you spent all that time in this dank, dark grimness down in the depths of Blighttown, and Sen's isn't exactly cheery either," she explains. "When the gargoyles fly you up and you see the sunlight, the castle, the church, it's amazing. The design there is amazing, too. Alex got lost for hours his first time around, but my eyes went straight to the broken window. The Tomb Raider fan in me was going, 'I bet I can get through that window.' Meanwhile, the Resident Evil fan in me was going, 'Where are the dogs?'" Alex's favorite place is Firelink Shrine. "It just feels like home," he says. "When we first started playing, Leanne thought the music was depressing, and I guess it is, but it becomes the most beautiful music in the world because it means you're home and you're safe. Every time you hear it, you can start to relax. And the fact that you can hear the bells ringing is a lovely touch. Every time you hear it, it's like, I don't know who you are, but well done." Since then, they've played through Dark Souls 2 together as well, though they've yet to tackle the game where it all began, Demon's Souls. Leanne bought him a special edition of the game for a birthday, but it's still in the shrink wrap. As hardworking developers, they don't get an enormous amount of time to actually play games together, but Dark Souls has been a constant in their relationship, and they've learned a lot about each other through their shared adventures with it. What I found out about Alex is that he loves to mess with people, laughs Leanne. But it was a pretty intense bonding experience back when we first got together. Even if all the social time that we spent together was killing skeletons and farming Titanite, which is frankly weird, we found out that we were like-minded individuals. Exact the bloody same, even. Alex and Leanne embody how Dark Souls' jolly cooperation sometimes extends far beyond the game and into our real lives. Not only do they live in the same place now, they also have a little daughter together. Though Alex reckons she won't be playing Dark Souls for a while yet. I wonder whether getting through Dark Souls together has helped set them up to deal with the other real-world challenges that every relationship faces. Surely after you've been through the catacombs together, nothing else really seems that bad. They laugh. Well, we've had a remarkably smooth IKEA experience, says Leanne. I just put that down to the fact that we've Dark Souls first, and if we can get through that without wanting to kill each other, well, everything else is pretty easy, right? Postscript. Shortly before we went to print, Alex proposed to Leanne. Here he is, down on one knee in a Solaire hoodie. Praise the sun! A Tour of Lordran. Sen's Fortress, by Jason Killingsworth. Having touched the deep earth cul-de-sac of Ash Lake, we're going to head above ground once more and undertake the climb to Lordran's higher reaches. It's refreshing to sip a breath of fresh air and feel sunlight warming your plate mail after tunneling like a mole beneath ground for several hours. Plus, there's no way to follow a perfectly linear path through an open world with more branching limbs than Google image search results for Hindu gods. Most players' first visit to Sen's Fortress lasts about 2 or 3 minutes. The gate is closed. You linger on the front steps for a moment, casting about for a doorbell that doesn't exist. How vexing. And then you eventually wander back the way you came, unsure how to crack its perimeter. A state of befuddlement that lasts as long as it takes to open a browser window on your phone and search for the solution. As we mentioned, Sen's Fortress doesn't have a doorbell. It has two. Only once you've rung the Bells of Awakening, one atop the Undead Church, one in Kellag's Domain, does a giant perched atop the fortress draw up the front gate by tugging an enormous chain-link pulley. For a long time, I thought the phrase Bell of Awakening was just a reflexive convention of the fantasy genre, e.g. Boots of Swiftness, Helmet of Clarity, Tunic of Luminescence, regal-sounding but meaningless. Now it seems obvious that the awakening in question refers to the literal rousing of the only creature strong enough to permit entry. In the cutscene, you can see the giant lift his head up from a drooped position when he hears the second bell chime. Wakey, wakey. The pathway leading up to Sen's entrance is a thing of beauty. Dense forest on either side funnels your eye to the imposing gateway directly ahead, which resembles a gaping jaw due to the teeth-like spikes lining the bottom of the half-raised gate. You're right to be nervous. Sen's is a masterpiece of brutalist architecture. No ornate touches, just a wordless declaration of might and impenetrability. This is the proving ground, after all, for those who wish to set foot in the hallowed city of On Orlando, perched high atop the adjacent cliff. If Sen's exterior appears designed by a military tactician, interior decorating duties seem to have been delegated to the torture-porn auteur Jigsaw himself. Was Dark Souls the game he kept yammering on about wanting to play? Scythes tick-tock back and forth across lofty gangways, vying with each other to see who gets to send you on a fatal plunge to the basement far below. Coffins bearing the decorative torso of a silver knight litter the hallways, presumably housing the corpses of those whom Sen proved to be unworthy. Cages hang on suspended chains. Serpent-headed soldiers and mages patrol the corridors, which, in combination with the ornamental coffins, infuses Egyptian mythological seasoning into the game's broth. Floor plate booby traps send flurries of darts shooting out of the wall when stepped on. Treasure chest mimics lie in wait. Sen's Fortress feels precisely like what you'd get if you'd had a gamer, or Rube Goldberg for that matter, build your grimdark obstacle course. One feature in particular feels plucked right out of the classic arcade. In the upper level of Sen's Fortress, giants laboriously plunk spherical boulders through a rooftop hole onto a pedestal, from which a hammer mechanism sends them rolling down floor-wide grooves. The effect feels like being trapped inside a medieval pinball machine. Since we already know that Miyazaki-san and his fellow designers enjoy laying traps for players in areas where they don't make thematic sense, Sen's background lore allows the game designers to completely drop the pretense of fair play and be as sadistic as they please. Maybe it's sadomasochistic to say so, but it feels good to be toyed with in this way. Conquering the gauntlet of Sen's fortress feels like cheating on one's executioner. Remember how good it felt to thwart GLaDOS's incinerator in Portal's final act? It's fun to imagine Dark Souls designers gritting their teeth as you emerge from Sen's upper reaches with your head still attached to your shoulders. I Complete You, The Quest to 100% Dark Souls, by Jason Killingsworth. February 9th, 2013. There was no confetti cannon blast when I eventually unlocked the Dark Soul achievement, which means you've hit 100% completion threshold. No music either, just the erratic percussion of a hammer striking an anvil, punctuated by a pair of tantalizingly spaced achievement unlocked sound cues. The final unticked items on my to-do list required me to ascend weapons using the souls of slain bosses, and there's only one blacksmith in the game who can get the job done, a giant in On Orlando. Sitting on a wooden stool with hammer in hand, he pauses briefly to introduce himself in Yoda speak. "Hello. Forge I can. Strong I am." I remember the sequence clearly, mainly because I videotaped it as one might a child's high school graduation ceremony. I perched my point-and-click camera on a spare cardboard box and trained it on the television a short distance away. Screen capture of the lowest rent variety, to be sure, but I'm sentimental and wanted a keepsake in exchange for the grueling hours I'd logged to get there. To the 236 YouTube viewers who've been riveted by the clip as of this writing, it probably looks as though I'm taking ages to confirm my weapon upgrade choice in an attempt to inject drama into a mindless bit of menu navigation. The truth is that, just centimeters from the finish line, I felt as calm as one might while evacuating a pine cone. The Dark Soul achievement requires you to play through the game roughly 2.5 times on a single profile, all the way up to New Game Plus Plus. Of the 50 rare weapons that must be stockpiled to unlock the Knight's Honor achievement, 3 of them require the Soul of Sif, an early game boss, as a crafting component. And since you can only defeat the Grey Wolf Sif and bag his soul once per playthrough, it's impossible to acquire all the weapons needed to unlock the Knight's Honor achievement without completing sequential runs, each one more ornery than the one preceding it. As if designed for the sole purpose of unsettling players slogging toward 100% completion, 2 of the weapons crafted from Sif's soul share the exact same billing in-game, Great Sword of Artorias. To satisfy the terms of Knight's Honor, you need both a cursed and non-cursed version of Artorias' greatsword, but you can only detect the cursed version by examining its stats. Based on the title alone, it looks as though you're about to craft a duplicate item, which would mean persisting well into New Game Plus Plus for another chance to kill Sif and reach the giant blacksmith in On Orlando, a heartburn-inducing prospect. Even though I felt sure I was crafting the cursed version of the Great Sword of Artorias, I took a few extra seconds to squint at the projected stats of the new item to reassure myself before clicking OK. With Artorias' cursed, hopefully, Great Sword in my inventory, just one weapon ascension remained. The Great Lord Great Sword is crafted by fusing the soul acquired by defeating the game's final boss, Gwyn, Lord of Cinder, with a fully leveled +10 straight sword. Any straight sword will do, but rather than finishing my trek to 100% completion like a marathoner limping across a finish line, I wanted to feel more like a spiraling gymnast sticking a dismount. For sentimental style points, I had a unique weapon leveled and waiting to be coupled with Gwyn's soul, a sunlight straight sword that originally had belonged to Solaire of Astora. Believed by many in the Souls community to be the estranged firstborn son of Gwyn, Solaire wanders Lordran in search of his son. What kind of son did Solaire have in mind? The answer's never made explicit, but I choose to believe it was his father, Gwyn. The game seems to bait this interpretation. In one early dialogue, Solaire casually explains, "The son is a wondrous body, like a magnificent father." And by seeing Solaire's quest line through to its bittersweet and inconclusive end, you can even summon him to assist in the boss fight against Gwyn. The son, a magnificent father. A son, whose name Solaire literally translates to solar or proceeding from the sun as light or heat. I had in mind a way of linking these two fires. Solaire's wandering carries overtones of banishment, neatly fitting the trope of other fallen deities cursed to walk the earth. If he is in fact the scorned son of Gwyn, how poetic, how poignant to be able to model the reunification with his estranged father by creating a surrogate ascension for his straight sword via bonding with the very soul of Gwyn, Solaire's weapon achieving the Great Lord status that would elude the once-upon-a-time heir. Knight's Honor achievement unlocked, 20 gamer score. The Dark Soul achievement unlocked, 50 gamer score. Formulating my own coda in which a father and son's bond is metaphorically redeemed through a Cilia weapon upgrade, priceless. Shortly before I undertook the quest to 100% Dark Souls, I informed my younger brother, then a newbie Souls convert, that I would not be undertaking the quest to 100% Dark Souls. It sounded like a bit of a chore, I told him. I was happy with what I'd accomplished in the game, I told him. I had nothing to prove, I told him. In retrospect, I was already flirting with the idea, sensing its magnetism. Perhaps on a subconscious level, I felt that vocalizing my resistance to the idea might help me thwart its tractor beam lock-on. An aesthetic genuflecting to avert the succubus's stare. I glanced over the requirements for the Dark Soul achievement out of academic interest, or so I convinced myself. By completing the game's central questline, one unlocks a respectable slice of the game's 41 achievements. Mopping up the remaining few, however, would demand a level of thoroughness that bordered on either the pathological or proctological. I couldn't decide which. Dark Souls' most gratifying achievements, in the traditional non-gamified sense, involve the slaying of epic bosses and successfully navigating each zone's baroque obstacle course, the kind of feats you associate with being a warrior. By contrast, pushing through the final marathon miles to become the Dark Soul more closely aligns with the profile of a scavenger. Welcome to a scavenger hunt designed to test even the most OCD-addled, carpal-tunnel-courting video game completionist. Acquire all rare weapons, including those looted from chests and corpses, crafted with boss souls, dropped by slain enemies through blind luck, or obtained by cleaving the tails of certain enemies. Acquire every last sorcery, pyromancy, and miracle in the game. Discover and join all 9 of the game's covenants. Ascend every weapon class in the game, standard, raw, crystal, lightning, magic, enchanted, divine, occult, fire, chaos, to the highest possible level. Even if I did take the plunge, what kind of alchemy would allow me to fabricate an abundance of discretionary gaming time by stringing together the circumstances of my life? A full-time job, a wife and 2 children under 3 years of age? As it turns out, there was no alchemy needed, just a big scheduling misdirect. When it looked as though I was going to be pulled away by work travel for the bulk of January and early February 2013, my wife decided she preferred to dodge the UK's numbing damp and stint of single parenting by arranging to fly with the kids to spend a month with her family in Orlando, Florida, praise the sun, etc., during my absence. Unexpectedly, as the date of her departure neared, my travel commitments for work dried up. One trip to Texas to interview a swath of its local game development scene morphed into a remote Skype-a-thon. A separate trip to a game dev conference in San Francisco fell through, as my editor decided it would be more economical to use freelancers already on the ground. These were lean times for print publishing, after all. Wife and kids eventually departed for Orlando, and I found myself waking up in an empty flat, like some adult facsimile of Home Alone's Kevin McAllister. Had my unspoken wish to 100% Dark Souls caused the family to vanish, leaving me at home to indulge the whims of my inner 8-year-old? I didn't even have Maiming Joe Pesci to distract me from spending an entire Saturday in pajamas farming Titanite shards from Blighttown swamp leeches. Turned out I'd need a mountain of them to complete the needed weapon upgrades on my checklist. When the family flew out, my first thought wasn't, aha, now here's my chance to get the Dark Souls achievement. I'd simply forgotten how tedious the bachelor life could be for a seasoned indoorsman like myself. More than a year after Dark Souls 2011 release, I was still in that zone where other video games felt gristly and bland by comparison. I thought I might use my surprised windfall of free time to clear a few games off my backlog, but it quickly became obvious I just wanted to sink more hours into Dark Souls. I'd already completed the game multiple times. What excuse could I use to justify another 30 to 40 hours trekking through Lordran? I hadn't yet unlocked all of the achievements in the game. I hadn't planned on doing so, but now I had the time if I wanted to. Did I want to? Why the hell not? Might even be fun. I printed out itemized lists of all the sundries I needed to collect, all those rare weapons, pyromancies, sorceries, miracles, and covenants, a list of all the achievements in the game so I could keep track of which ones I had yet to unlock. Bundles of pages stapled together. I'd undertaken the work of a project manager, plotting out tasks and subtasks to make sure everything got done. I kept the stack of pages on the entertainment stand next to my television with a black pen resting atop. That way I could easily access them while I played. Plus, having hard copies meant I could strike through items in real time as I added them to my inventory, each inky line a swing of the metaphorical ice pick pulling me closer to the summit, which felt cloud-covered and remote up until the very moment I set foot there. My quest to become the Dark Soul had begun. I was committed, all in, 100%. I fished my pile of old scavenger hunt checklists out of storage prior to writing this chapter. At the top of one page, there's a handwritten note that reads, "Fire upgrade, 10 green titanite, 7 red chunks, 1 slab." For the most part, my contributions consist solely of margin ticks and the litany of strikethroughs that make the document resemble some Dark Souls-themed intelligence report full of redactions. The surplus of farming required to complete all the weapon upgrades prompted me to jot numbers in the margin to keep track of how many titanite pieces I needed in order to get the base weapon upgraded to a point where they could then be ascended. The Dark Soul quest is like a marathon, in that it requires stubbornness and tenacity to power through. But it differs from a marathon in that the scenery doesn't change at a steady clip. Every task with a farming requirement attached to it forces you to rerun a narrow slice of a level where the enemy species most likely to drop it resides. You butcher all those enemies. Occasionally one of them drops what you need. More often, they don't. Then you rest at a bonfire to repopulate all the monsters you've just slain so you can do the loop again. Each farming requirement becomes yet another roundabout along the marathon route you're obligated to circle 50 times before you can continue on your way to the finish. Playing Dark Souls for fun involves the kind of farming you might find on a small, family-operated farm. Playing Dark Souls as an achievement hunter is to spend a couple of weeks working on one of those industrial factory farms you see on documentaries promoting veganism. The monsters you have to kill by the dozen to secure the item drops you need pose no gameplay challenge. They might as well be Eeyore-faced cattle filing placidly onto the Dark Souls version of a kill floor. The farming isn't restricted to upgrading weapons either. Some of the required items on your checklist are given out as rewards for hitting a certain rank in a covenant. For instance, if you want to lay your hands on the Gravelord Greatsword Dance Miracle, you need to offer a total of 10 Eyes of Death to Gravelord Nido in order to achieve the +1 rank in his Gravelord Covenant. Off I'd go to my browser to Google best places to farm Eyes of Death. Turns out the Basilisks in the Depth drop them every so often. Some dude on the GameFAQs message board said he was able to farm a grand total of 6 from those Basilisks in just 1 hour. Anytime you'd come across one of these anecdotal time estimates, you could typically double it and be somewhere in the ballpark. Random number generators are psychopathic. They are incapable of empathy. They watch you suffer and feel nothing. Now that I've uttered the G-word, rhymes with bugle, let me say I'm not ashamed of my decision to summon the wisdom of the internet to aid my quest to become the Dark Soul. I journeyed through Lordran for the first time with precious little guidance. I know what it's like to wander in darkest ignorance, to have a stacked curse and no idea how to lift it. Then again, I don't resent people who rely on guidance, even during their first playthrough. The person who climbs Mount Everest doesn't sheepishly confess to using a Sherpa. The person who dons robes and attends her university graduation doesn't apologize for mining textbooks for the information they needed to complete the requisite coursework. The joy of discovery and the joy of learning are two separate things entirely. I experienced the awe and rush of unaided exploration in my maiden playthrough. The purpose of my quest to reach 100% completion was to illuminate some of the lingering gaps in my knowledge of Dark Souls, and for that I needed to climb the scaffolding of communal expertise. I swan-dove into the various Dark Souls wikis and forums and message boards. Like Bill Murray learning the piano in Groundhog Day, I used my 2.5 playthroughs in pursuit of the Dark Lord achievement to complete all the NPC quest lines. Despite trying to follow the recipes of Solaire's quest to the letter, I inadvertently caused him to go raving mad because I didn't fully breach the threshold into Lost Izalith before returning to his location in the shortcut passage. Instead of finding him sitting on the ground moping as expected, he came at me, bro. I journeyed all that way with him, dutifully following the steps laid out, hoping to save him, and instead I was forced to put him down. At least it meant I'd come into possession of his Sunlight Straight Sword, which would go to good use at the tail end of my quest. Since I was already obligated to see the NG Plus campaign through to the end, I had another chance to save him, and I'd get it right that time. Fumbling Solaire's Quest wasn't my most resounding facepalm en route to completing the Dark Soul achievement. That would come in New Game Plus Plus toward the very end of my quest. I can't even recall now why I needed to retrieve the large ember from the depths before making my way to On Orlando to complete the last of my boss soul weapon crafting, but I was a bit exhausted by this point and eager to finish. To kill Sif for the third time and ring the subterranean bell of awakening to reach On Orlando, I was able to shave time by using the Master Key starting item to take the shortcut through New Londo Ruins, which provides speedy access to both Darkroot Darden and Blighttown. Reaching the depths in the conventional way would require me to wade through a couple extra boss battles, and by now I was losing patience. I was in a rush, and I got sloppy. I thought to myself, if I can take a back door into Blighttown, why don't I just access the depths from the reverse side by scaling the shanty maze? If you think descending the maze of ladders and platforms in Blighttown was a chore, try climbing all the way back up from swamp level. It's like trying to recite the alphabet backwards. In all my time playing Dark Souls, I'd never climbed my way upward through Blighttown. Relieved to have made it all the way to the top of the concrete drainage pipe, I found myself standing in front of a very, very closed door. You probably anticipated this the moment I spelled out my plan. The door blocking my way could only be opened from one side, with a key dropped by the gaping dragon. I suppose I learned something else, a variation on a worthy axiom. Measure twice, reverse shortcut once. The Derp Soul, achievement unlocked. Dark Souls still feels bottomless to me. I've tried so hard to exhaust it. Even after completing the Dark Soul achievement, I continue to learn new things about the game. If I searched YouTube for Dark Soul this very second and picked a Let's Play video at random, I'm confident I'd witness some new gameplay, lore, or environmental wrinkle I never knew existed. I've learned so much since returning to the game to work on this book, to the point that it's made me question whether it's disingenuous to put myself forward as a subject matter expert. Since the game's journey of discovery has no clear end, part of me hoped that the quest to reach 100% completion would help provide a conclusive, if arbitrary, bookend to my time with the game and allow me to lay my obsession to rest. Returning to a static action RPG quest repeatedly over the course of a lifetime feels intuitively frivolous, no matter how exalted the work may be. The hundreds of unplayed games in our Steam libraries roll their eyes as we sheepishly skirt them in favor of another romp with Dark Souls. Online games such as League of Legends and Destiny patch frequently with new things to explore. From Software unveiled one additional strip of Lordran in the Artorias of the Abyss expansion, admittedly, but there will be no more forthcoming. The studio has moved on, so why can't I? I suspect that whatever guilt I feel over my Dark Souls fixation derives from years inhaling the secondhand smoke of wider culture's condescension towards games. Read James Joyce's Ulysses 100 times, write essays about it, parse it endlessly with strangers on the internet, and you're a scholar, but do the same thing with a video game and you're a fanboy? Why do I feel the obligation to establish a bookend? Dark Souls isn't a book, after all. It's entirely separate reality. If you discovered that you'd accidentally come into the possession of C.S. Lewis's magical wardrobe through a fortuitous secondhand furniture purchase, would you limit the number of times you permitted yourself to go paddling through Narnia's snowy wood? I clearly haven't put my infatuation with Dark Souls to rest. I won't ever. The only thing anybody ought to deem 100% conclusive is the coroner's clipboard. As long as I'm breathing and my thumbs work, I'll continue to be a Dark Souls astronomer, delighted and confounded by how many unmet constellations emerge when you squint into any given patch of its night sky. A Tour of Lordran, On Orlando, by Jason Killingsworth. The majority of open-world games are flat. Their topography might vary slightly, hills, valleys, possibly a mountain range, but players will still spend most of their time adventuring north, east, south, or west across a scenic sprawl. Dark Souls' most revolutionary contribution to the genre is that it invites you to explore a world that feels as deep as it is wide. At times you're venturing down into the deepest reaches of the earth. At other stages of the game, you're charting a climb towards nose-bleeding altitudes. After a lifetime of traversing action RPG worlds, as you might go about eating a big, tasty crepe, navigating Dark Souls for the first time feels like being an insect nibbling through a layered wedding cake the size of the Burj Khalifa. The upward climb toward the roof of Sen's Fortress marks the start of Dark Souls' most memorable vertical ascension. One expects a roof to be a dead end, akin to scaling a tree to its highest branch, but after showing the iron golem who's boss, something rapturous, in the Christian bodily sense, occurs. You're about to visit a heavenly city. Yet, in a deliciously subversive twist, the winged creatures the game dispatches to carry you there are not angels, but instead snarling, emaciated gargoyles. Consider it a dab of foreshadowing. The first glimpse of On Orlando is a pivotal and euphoric moment in the timeline of every player's journey through Dark Souls. After innumerable hours wandering the ruins and decay of Lordran below, what you behold upon arrival is a city utterly alien in its perfection and wholeness. On Orlando once served as a home to the gods, and you sure as hell don't need a lore expert to explain this fact. The signs are all there. On Orlando's location atop a forbidding cliff all but screams Mount Olympus. Sunlight blankets the city, god beams worthy of any self-respecting deity. White marble abounds, conveying purity. At first glance, the city appears to be entirely composed of cathedrals. Americans joke about certain towns in the country's highly religious southern states having a church on every corner. You could say the same about On Orlando, however each one of its churches just so happens to boast the grandiosity of St. Peter's Basilica. The most imposing cathedral in the city looks like a freakishly steroidal Cinderella castle from Disney's theme parks. In terms of pathfinding, there's no ambiguity about where your journey through On Orlando will reach its culmination. All is not right, however. This is Dark Souls, in case you'd forgotten. The firekeeper guarding the first bonfire you discover laments, "If not for me, what beacon would there be in this lost city?" All that sunlight you've been shading your eyes against? All that heavenly fire and warmth? Too good to be true. An illusion wrought by sorcery to keep up a charade, like a family away on holiday leaving a lamp lit in the front room to make it seem like nothing's amiss. Gwyn's youngest child, Gwyndolin, the only god to remain behind after the rest of his family departed on Orlando, has conjured a projection of his sister Guinevere, along with the sky's deceptively bright countenance. Attack the illusion of Guinevere, however, and she vanishes, along with the illusion of sunlight, causing a pall of twilight to cover the city. Within On Orlando, you'll need to secure a crucial artifact known as the Lord Vessel, but it lies tucked behind one of the most demanding boss encounters in the game, a fearsome pair known as Smo and Ornstein. Having to fight two bosses at the same time seems needlessly cruel, even by Dark Souls standards. Then again, it's certainly a convenient way of motivating players to try out the game's co-op summoning mechanic, even if they've insisted on flying solo up to that point. When Ornstein comes blitzing toward you as you enter the boss arena, prepare to be slain in the spear hit. In this game, even heaven can be hell. Final Boss: Understanding Dark Souls' Creator, by Keza McDonald. What do you imagine when you picture the kind of person responsible for the nerve-shredding gauntlet that is Dark Souls? Does your mind conjure an intimidating figure with crossed arms and cruel eyes? Or a creative sadist, perhaps, along the lines of John Doe from the movie Seven, only with glasses, obviously, because this is a game developer we're talking about. A tortured, brooding soul like Angel from Buffy the Vampire Slayer, but good at coding? In reality, Dark Souls director Hidetaka Miyazaki is neither intimidating nor obviously troubled by some inner darkness. He's a quiet, affable, slightly mysterious Japanese chap, quick to laugh, easy to be around. But he does wear glasses. Unlike many auteurs, Miyazaki is not an egocentric man. Or, if he is, he hides it very well. He's generally reluctant to talk about himself. In the years after Demon's Souls suddenly thrust his work into the limelight, he was actually reluctant to talk that much at all, at least to the press or to the public. This is a great shame for fans of the Souls series, because when Hidetaka Miyazaki does talk, he's extremely interesting to listen to. He has this thoughtful, literary turn of phrase that translation rarely does justice. Fans seize on his every word because, unlike most video games of its scale, Dark Souls bears the image of its creator. Where most games are composite creations, influenced and guided by hundreds of pairs of hands, Dark Souls' singularity and consistency of vision owes much to Miyazaki's detailed, hands-on style of direction. He sits with his programmers, designers, and artists and takes an interest in everything from a character's resting animation to the length of a piece of body armor. He often defers to his team when talking about how Souls was made, but, and this is not to diminish the role of any of the other talented people who worked on the game, his overall aesthetic and thematic sensibilities filter down through the team and into the tiniest nuances of Dark Souls. Put simply, without Miyazaki, there would be no Dark Souls at all. Hidetaka Miyazaki was born in Shizuoka, a city on the east coast of Japan, about halfway between Tokyo and Nagoya. Shizuoka is not one of the more storied Japanese cities. Most residents of Honshu, the main island of Japan, know it only as a stop on the Shinkansen bullet train to Kaido mainline from Tokyo to Osaka, though it has a few places where you can catch a good view of Mount Fuji. His parents were office workers, and in a 2015 interview with The Guardian, he described his upbringing as tremendously poor. He spent most of his childhood and teenage years reading, borrowing books and manga from the local library, and playing tabletop RPGs. He doesn't self-identify as an ambitious person. The fact that he has become one of the most interesting figures in game development is, as far as he's concerned, something of an accident. Miyazaki didn't start working for From Software until 2004, after completing a degree at Keio University and working at an IT company for several years. He was 29, and From was one of the few companies that would hire him with no experience. He began as a coder on Armored Core, but when he caught wind of an action fantasy project spinning rudderless within the company, he saw an opportunity. That game was Demon's Souls, and From was struggling to convert the premise into a gripping demo. It was a perfect opportunity for Miyazaki. He could turn the game into anything he wanted, and because expectations for the project were already low, there would be little blowback if it didn't pan out. He conspired with Sony producer Takashi Kaji to hide the extent of the game's difficulty from higher-ups, who would certainly have misunderstood it. Quote, "He felt that if it were too forthright about all the death, about this concept, with the marketing people, they would have run a mile," Miyazaki told me in 2011. "So that's why we had to be a bit sneaky about it." At first, their bet appeared to be a flop. Demon's Souls struggled at retail, at least initially. Quote, "I thought at that point I'd never be able to make an original game again," Miyazaki told me years later in 2015. "I certainly didn't expect any of this at that moment. It's hard to believe." But it turned out to be the beginning of an astronomic rise. The first time I interviewed Hidetaka Miyazaki in person in 2011, just a month or so before Dark Souls came out, he was poised on the brink of his first real success. Demon's Souls had burrowed into the Western psyche by then, and he found himself in the unexpected position of being able to make a sequel. He didn't care for interviews back then, reticent and uncomfortable with eye contact, but it was clear from an hour of conversation that he had an estimable intellect. We talked about his game's approach to difficulty, which at that point was still quite novel, about death as a motif in the Dark Souls world, and about how he was handling all the sudden attention as the new face of Japanese game development. "The pressure is like a muscle ache after you train," he said. "It's painful, but it's satisfying to know that you're growing. In that way, I'm really enjoying it." Originally, he never wanted his photo to be published, and he never liked interacting with the media, says Ryan Morris, the writer and translator who has worked with him on all of the Souls games. He has some personal ideas about the relationship between creators and consumers, and I think that he believes a certain amount of distance is a good thing for the mystique of the product. He's not aloof in any way, but he's just not one of those directors who loves every chance to talk or get in the limelight. He kind of stays behind the scenes. Life is very different for Hidetaka Miyazaki nowadays. He has transitioned into a new role as president of From Software, which makes staying behind the scenes an impossibility. The last time I saw him, he was giving a presentation on Dark Souls 3 before a packed house. He stood confidently, tablet in hand, sporting a well-fitting suit jacket over smart jeans, keeping his eyes fixed on a point somewhere just above the audience's head. His manner has changed, too. He's more outwardly confident, more comfortable sharing his sense of humor. His job now entails making big decisions about the future of From, traveling, meeting other company directors with whom he has a strange fascination. He told one interviewer for The Guardian that he sometimes bases enemy characters on them. And yet he still has the time for the exact same style of detailed hands-on direction for which he has been known since Demon's Souls. It's always seemed to me that, rather like Tolkien, the worlds that Miyazaki designs exist fully formed in his head before a single line of code is written, and his main challenge as a director involves communicating these worlds to the people who help create them. Miyazaki doesn't quite agree with that. Your assessment captures half the story, he says. When I create a game, I begin by defining the core concept, and at the same time creating a general idea of several pillars that will support the core concept. These can be ideas concerning the game system, level design, game universe, narrative, art, etc. I also start to imagine the size of these pillars, and their relations to one another. After that point, the core concept never changes, but the supporting pillars do. I'm fortunate enough to have many trusted and talented designers on my team, and as part of the development process, we hammer things out through discussion. When the ongoing process of brushing up uncovers anything that could improve the final game, that discovery is applied immediately and without hesitation within the existing framework. This is made possible partly due to my directing style, in which I have a direct hand in most aspects of the game. I believe that this is a vital process, despite the imperfections that may arise due to my own shortcomings. This allows me to immediately embrace change, even in mid-development. When you talk to Miyazaki's colleagues, this hands-on approach is the first thing they bring up. When I visited From Software in 2015, one of the lead artists on Bloodborne told me, "Director Miyazaki is much like an art director himself, the way he works, so he gives the art staff very specific, concrete ideas on what he wants. The team works together with Miyazaki on specific nuances of how things should look in the design." Masaki Yamigawa, the Sony producer who worked with Miyazaki and From Software, calls him a very interesting director and a very logical person. "He's very willing to kind of let us do our thing and let creative people give their input," says Ryan, the Souls series localization collaborator. "He'll respond to that and try to let things flow naturally rather than being too commanding." In nearly 11 years of gaming reporting, I've never come across another company president who takes this kind of approach. There are other directors who enjoy unilateral oversight. Hideo Kojima springs to mind, but none who also have to run a company. Miyazaki sees his close involvement in the creative process as just part of the job of being president. "Having such a hands-on approach to everything is very important to me, but it's also important to the company," he says. "The most important thing is to create something great, no matter how long that takes." The development team understands that, the surrounding staff understand that, the chair people understand that. So the way I see it, it's not about having the time to do everything, it's creating the time to do everything, ensuring it. Because without that, From would not be From. If we don't create something great, that compromises what we're all here to do. Even the board is lenient with me when I say I need more time to do something. People are accommodating. But that's because everyone understands the importance of quality. I feel very lucky, because I do get away with things for the good of the game. We've got a parent company now, Kadokawa, and they're very understanding. And our publishing partners are also accommodating to some of the things that I decide not to do, because in order to make time to make the game, I must forego some other duties. At any other game company, nobody would allow you to do that. Miyazaki has earned such trust over the past several years by repeatedly demonstrating the distinctiveness of his creative vision. His inspirations occupy a wider range than many other game developers, who occasionally seem to have spent their cultural attention doing nothing but watching and rewatching Star Wars and Lord of the Rings. Miyazaki grew up trying to decipher fantasy fiction from his local library rather than playing games. Apart from Ico, which he speaks about in extremely complimentary terms, he doesn't often name other video games that have got his creative engine humming. That's not to suggest he's oblivious to the other creative directors in the field, even those working on more populist offerings. When my co-author Jason interviewed Miyazaki prior to the release of Dark Souls 2 and stressed that his fans would be interested in the reasons for his lack of involvement in the sequel, just as Gears of War fans would be interested in Cliff Bleszinski or hypothetically to announce, while still at Epic, that he wouldn't be directing the next Gears of War sequel, Miyazaki replied, "You should not compare me with Cliff Bleszinski. He's on a higher level than me." "Miyazaki is extremely smart," says Ryan. "A little beyond me, if I'm honest, but I try to keep up with him. I suspect there is a darkness in him somewhere, but if there is, he lets it out in the games, not when you're interacting with him. He's also just a through-and-through geek. He loved Magic the Gathering. I think he was in a club back in university. And lots of anime. And, as it happens, a lot of the things I like. There's the Berserk comic, which is the foundation of his creative vision sometimes, and Game of Thrones. He's a massive fan of English fantasy. I've always been such a huge fan of George R.R. Martin that it overwhelms me," Miyazaki says. His approach to fantasy is kind of like the Romance of the Three Kingdoms, the Chinese historical political drama, which I'm a fan of as well. The political elements are a lot of fun, and the drama is done really well, too. Unsurprisingly, he seems most enthusiastic about the fantasy that is devoid of happy endings. He's also mentioned Beowulf and the Nibelungen Lied as favorite works, two grim Northern European legends that can essentially be summarized as bad things happen, then everybody dies. He gets inspiration from a lot of different things, but his strongest inspiration comes from novels, says Yamagawa. He's a big fan of literature. He'll read a book and be like, this, and underline a section and show it to the artists and attempt to draw. He's not an artist himself, but he'll draw what he's looking for. He does everything in his power to expand his imagination so that his worlds take on a life of their own. I'm very impressed by that. He doesn't take much inspiration from real life, though, apart, presumably, from those boss characters he models after fellow executives. Miyazaki does not see anything autobiographical in his work. Most of my creative drive is derived from a yearning for things that are absent from my life, a notion of experiences that will never be had, or things that will never be encountered in our age, or even in this world, he says. Naturally, such yearnings are products of my life and life experiences, so they do reflect upon me, but I don't imagine that they could be considered autobiographical. For example, given all the overt religious iconography and ritual present in both the Soul series and Bloodborne, one might guess that Miyazaki holds a predilection for the sacred and spiritual. He disavows personal piety, as it happens, yet admits to offering up the occasional prayer when circumstances feel beyond his control. The reason for including the symbolic items that are present in Dark Souls, crosses, kneeling, churches, demons, is to stay true to the world and the emotion that we're trying to express within the game. I've used the analogy of trying to grow seeds in dead ground. Whatever situation the player may be in, I feel strongly about this uncontrollable power, this miracle, the act of praying, whether it be to a god or something you believe in. There's this power or miracle, something that cannot be controlled by how you act or how you train. And that element is probably something that is very important to somebody that is in this devastating state, this hopeless, lonely, cold state. Trying to stay true to that concept and ideology is something that's important for the game. I tell my designers that the weapons and items are not an image of power or strength. They're an image of something that is your last hope, something you grasp onto in order to live, in order to achieve your goal. Having that desperation within the actions and visuals is something that's important in helping players understand what is involved in the game concept and design, and what is truly important in being able to feel the sense of satisfaction when you overcome these difficulties. The religious symbols evoke that uncontrollable element. I myself am not religious, but when I'm faced with something I cannot control, my last resort is to pray. It's that element that I want to express in the game. It can be anything, a being, prayer, hope, anything that's the last resort that you want to grasp onto. It's deep and hard to verbally explain, but there's this emotional impact I want to express. Miyazaki is fascinated by spaces, by shadows, both literal and metaphorical. He describes his game as full of blank space, whether it's in the lore or the level design. He likes to create intentional vacuums into which players can rush. We talk a lot in this book about how Dark Souls feels endless, how it always feels like there might be something more behind the curtain. And that's because, in stark contravention of normal game design protocol, there's so much of the game that cannot be seen on a single playthrough. I didn't know that Dark Sun Gwyndolin existed, for instance, about until a year ago. There had been this massive secret right there in Orlando that I'd never chanced upon. It blew my mind. I designed the world of Dark Souls, and indeed of all my games, to include patches of impenetrable darkness throughout, Miyazaki says. I believe that this mirrors the real world, and that it leaves more to the imagination of the player, and makes it easier for them to adopt the world as their own. I also think that it's more interesting if we never know the true boundaries of these patches of darkness. It sounds like you may have discovered Gwyndolin at the edge of the universe, after believing you had seen it all. If that is indeed the case, then I'm very pleased to hear it. It follows that while we were never concerned about being whether or not some things would be left eternally undiscovered by the users, the spirit of exploration amongst players goes far beyond the imagination. This notion had occurred to us while working on Dark Souls, and we remain firm believers in it. Despite that, Miyazaki is still continuously surprised by the force of players' reactions to Dark Souls. As I was telling him some of the stories included in this book, he kept laughing in disbelief. Once at a PlayStation experience, a fan talked to me and said he'd gotten married as a result of either Demons or Dark Souls. I never imagined making anything that had such an effect on people. It's a surreal experience, he told me. I suppose for a creator that's a wonderful thing, to have people who've been so affected by it, but I almost have trouble believing that it's true, he says. I wonder why, if all these people are getting married because of my game, why haven't I been able to get married? I receive fan letters too and enjoy reading them, usually while struggling with English. I'm unable to respond to them individually, but they are a source of joy. I tend to keep myself isolated, and these letters serve as precious stimuli and are a chance to reflect upon what it is that we are creating. But I must admit I prefer the kinder messages. As I mentioned in several interviews, I'm the type that responds better to positive reinforcement. Dark Souls director has taken well to his success and risen to the challenge that it has presented him with, but he has conflicted feelings about how long it will last. He's perhaps a bit too savvy to entirely buy into his own hype. Not too much has changed about the place where we make the games at From's offices, he says. Numbers have changed, we hear a lot from fans, but it feels like a mirage. I prefer it that way, because I feel like if I were to believe that this was deserved, that it was an affirmation of my own or From Software's talents, we'd get complacent. It would go to our heads, and we won't be able to do what we have always done so well. So I'm leaving it as a wonderful mirage and keeping at it. There's this expression in Japan, in political relations or business success, when the situation changes, people can change their tune very quickly. They can sound quite the opposite of how they did just a day previously. I always try to keep that fact in mind. Whether it's the game business or in a wider life, one's fortunes can reverse very quickly. I always remain cautious and remember that things can change very quickly, for better or for worse. As is abundantly clear from this book, I consider Dark Souls a masterpiece, but even masterpieces aren't perfect. And Hidetaka Miyazaki knows better than anyone what could have been better. Is there anything he'd do differently about Dark Souls if he could do it all again? Quote, Dark Souls is in some ways an incomplete game, and I like to think that it has been completed by players, by their discoveries as they moved along. I'd love to say that the nature of this incompleteness was completely deliberate, but it is both deliberate and by accident in different ways. And that's going to do it this week for Codex Radio. As always, if you'd like to send the show feedback, you can do so by tweeting at my account, @endless_odyssey, or the show's Twitter account, @codex_radio, or you can email the show at codexpodcast@myriadtruths.com. We'll see you next week. Thanks for listening.